Today is June the 16th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Google makes Workspace free for everyone. Google announced that it is making paid Workspace features available to non-paying Google account holders, creating a single integrated experience for everyone. Over the last year, we've delivered innovations that bring together the content, communications, and tasks to help millions of businesses, nonprofits, and classrooms transform how they collaborate, make the most of their time, and have more impact. A post written by Google Vice Presidents Kelly Wardher and Aparna Papu reads, "Now we're bringing those same innovations to everyone else, starting today. All of Google's Workspace is available to anyone with a Google account. To date, Google Workspace, previously called G Suite, has worked a bit like Microsoft Office 365. The firm offered both free and paid versions of services like Gmail, Docs and Sheets, and the paid versions offered more functionality alongside management capabilities. But with this change, paid Workspace features are now being made available to non-paying customers, creating a simpler, singular code base for Google to maintain and offering customers even more value." And one might argue that the newly free Workspace isn't really free, as you need to enable Google Chat in Gmail to access the paid features. Google Chat is Google's answers to Zoom, the darling of the pandemic era, and rival services like Microsoft Teams. Google is also introducing a new paid Workspace offering called Workspace Individual. This is aimed at entrepreneurs and other individuals who work alone or in very small businesses, and it provides premium services related to booking services, professional video meetings, and personalized email marketing. And Google says more features are planned for the future. Workspace Individuals is coming soon to Australia, Brazil, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and the United States. Federal judge tosses $15 a month internet law on ice. New York State Governor Cuomo signed the $15 affordable broadband bill on April the 16th. The Affordable Broadband Act, the first in the nation legislation, requires large internet service providers to offer a $15 affordable broadband plan to qualifying New Yorkers starting June the 16th. The average price of broadband in New York is currently $50 a month. This new bill caps the price at $15 for regular broadband and $20 for high-speed broadband, but only for those who qualify as low income. There are over 7.3 million households in New York State, and that's still over 7 million people in 2.7 million households, according to a press release from Cuomo's office. In other words, more than a third of households would qualify for internet access capping at $15. Well, the ISPs in New York went to court. On Friday, the broadband industry won a court order that prohibits New York from enforcing a state law that would require ISPs to sell $15 per month broadband plans to low-income households. Lobby groups for ISPs sued New York to block the law that was scheduled to take effect on June the 15th, and it received a preliminary injunction from U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York. The state law is preempted by federal law, U.S. District Judge Dennis Hurley wrote in that order. While the case will continue, Hurley found that the industry is likely to succeed in its lawsuit. The Affordable Broadband Act would require ISPs to offer all qualifying low-income households at least 2 internet access plans. Download speeds of at least 25 megabits per second at no more than $15 per month, or download speeds of at least 200 megabits per second at no more than $20 per month, that the low-income qualifications specified by the law cover about 7 million New Yorkers in 2.7 million households, which is over one-third of all households in the state. The law allows exceptions to the minimum speed requirements where such download speed is not reasonably practical. The New York State law is rate regulation, and rate regulation is a form of common carrier treatment, Hurley wrote, rejecting arguments made by New York State Attorney General Letitia James. In defendants' words, the ABA, or the Affordable Broadband Act, concerns plaintiffs' pricing practices by creating a price regime that sets a price ceiling, which flatly contradicts her simultaneous assertion that the ABA does not rate regulate broadband services. Price ceilings regulate rates. The judge rejected New York's argument that the Federal Communications Commission abandoned its authority to regulate broadband at all when Chairman Ajit Pai led a vote to undo the common carrier classification that was imposed on ISPs during the Obama era. In reclassifying the broadband internet as a Title I information service, the FCC made the affirmative decision not to treat it as a common carrier, the judge wrote. The FCC's affirmative decision is different from an abdication of jurisdiction writ large, even though Title I may not confer as expansive of powers as, say, Title II and its grant to impose common carrier obligations. Hurley quoted from the Supreme Court's Brand X ruling from 2005, which said that information service providers are not subject to mandatory common carrier regulation under Title II, though the Commission has jurisdiction to impose additional regulatory obligations under its Title I ancillary jurisdiction to regulate interstate and foreign communications. Ultimately, the New York law conflicts with the implied preemptive effect of both the FCC's 2018 order and the Communications Act. The FCC's preemption power is limited. Pai tried to preempt all state net neutrality laws, even ones that didn't exist at the time of his order, and was rebuffed in court. But Hurley decided that the ruling in that separate case does not preclude or revoke the 2018 order implicit preemptive effect. The judge also found that the state law is preempted because it covers an interstate communication service. The fact that the law only covers internet users based in New York does not offset the fact that broadband access itself is an interstate service with transmissions that routinely cross state lines, the judge wrote. The sole basis on which defendant relies to call the ABA intrastate is its applicability only to companies that have chosen to provide service in New York. But any state law can be construed as applicable only to those subject to that state's jurisdiction, which accordingly does not make it intrastate. The key to the FCC jurisdiction, the line between inter versus intrastate, is the nature of communication itself rather than the physical location of the technology or the consumers served. Because the ABA regulates within the field of interstate communications, it triggers field preemption, binding Second Circuit decisions are clear. The Communications Act's broad scheme for the regulation of interstate service by communications carriers indicate an intent on the part of Congress to occupy the field to the exclusion of state law. Judge Hurley found that a preliminary injunction is needed to prevent ISPs from suffering unrecoverable losses. Beginning June 15th, which was yesterday, plaintiff will suffer unrecoverable losses increasing with time and the enormity of the matter. six plaintiffs with multiple member organizations attacking a statute affecting one-third of all New York households portends a lengthy litigation. The lawsuit against New York was filed by New York State Telecommunications Association, U.S. Telecom, CTIA, the Wireless Association, NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association, the Satellite Broadcasting and Communications Association, and America's Communications Association. Judge Hurley also cited statements from ISPs that suggest the law may reduce internet access statewide by discouraging expansion. Empire Telephone Corporation's declarant avers that Empire will have to cancel expansion projects, which, if completed, would result in Empire serving more than 20,000 households, thereby disqualifying Empire from an exemption. Hurley wrote, providers with fewer than 20,000 residential customers eligible for exceptions from the law. Hurley quoted two other small ISPs making similar claims. Verizon expands return policy to 30 days. Buying a device and messing around with it for a few days only to decide that it most definitely is not the one for you and that spending the next 2 years with it would be hell can be a terrifying scenario. Of course, most companies offer return policies of varying lengths to help you out in these situations. But when a company expands theirs, you should be aware. Verizon expanded their return policy for both devices and accessories in a big way. Starting now, Verizon is giving customers a full 30 days to return devices or accessories. After taking a quick look at the new return policy, the length of time appears to be the only major change. Previously, customers had 14 days to bring back their disappointing purchase, and now they have 30 days. Keep in mind that the $50 restocking fee still applies to devices, so this process isn't exactly free. The fee used to be $35, but has been at this higher $50 number for some time. There is no fee for accessory returns. In the past, Verizon has played with expanded return periods during the holidays. This, however, is a permanent change that is already live on their website. Apple's tightly controlled App Store is teeming with scams. According to the Washington Post, nearly 2% of Apple's top-grossing apps on one day were scams, and they have cost people $48 million. Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, has long argued it needs to control app distribution on iPhones, otherwise the App Store would turn into a flea market. But among the 1.8 million apps on the App Store, scams are hiding in plain sight. Customers for several VPN apps, which allegedly protect users' data, complain in Apple's App Store reviews that the apps told users that devices had been infected by a virus to dupe them into downloading and paying for software they don't need. A QR code reader app that remains on the store tricks customers into paying $4.99 a week for a service that is now included in the camera app of the iPhone. Some apps fraudulently present themselves as being from major brands such as Amazon and Samsung. Of the highest 1,000 grossing apps on the App Store, nearly 2% are scams, according to an analysis by the Washington Post, and those apps have bilked consumers out of an estimated $48 million during the time they've been on the App Store, according to market research firm App Figures. The scale of the problem has never before been reported. What's more, Apple profits from these apps because it takes a cut of up to 30% of all revenues generated through the App Store. Even more common, according to the Post analysis, are fleeceware, apps that use inauthentic customers' reviews to move up in the App Store rankings and gives apps a sense of legitimacy to convince customers to pay higher prices for a service usually offered elsewhere with higher legitimate customers' reviews. Two-thirds of the 18 apps the Post flagged to Apple were removed from the App Store. the most valuable company in United States history, Apple is facing unprecedented scrutiny for how it wields its power and is fighting to hold on to it, including in a blockbuster trial that concluded last month. Regulators and competitors have zeroed in on the App Store in particular. Unlike App Stores on other mobile operating systems, Apple Store faces no competition and is the only way for iPhone owners to download software to their iPhones without bypassing Apple's restrictions. Through it, Apple keeps a tight grip on software distribution and payments on its mobile operating system called iOS. Apple has long maintained that its exclusive control of the App Store is essential to protecting customers, and it only lets the best apps on its system. But Apple's monopoly over how consumers access apps on iPhones can actually create an environment that gives customers a false sense of safety, according to experts. Because Apple doesn't face any major competition, and so many consumers are locked into using the App Store on iPhones, there's little incentive for Apple to spend money on improving it. If consumers were to have access to alternative app stores or other methods of distributing software, Apple would be a lot more likely to take the problem more seriously. Apple's spokesperson said, "We hold developers to high standards to keep the App Store a safe and trusted place for customers to download software, and we will always take action against apps that pose a harm to users. Apple leads the industry with practices that put the safety of our customers first, and we'll continue learning, evolving our practices, and investing the necessary resources to make sure customers are presented with the very best experience." Well, this is not really happening. Apple isn't the only company that struggles with this issue. They're also on Google's Play Store, which is available on its Android mobile operating system. But unlike Apple, Google doesn't claim that its Play Store is curated. Consumers can download apps from different stores on Android phones, creating competition between app stores. Apple says it is constantly improving its methods for sniffing out scams and usually catches them within a month of hitting the App Store. In a recent news release, Apple said it employed new tools to verify the authenticity of user reviews and last year kicked 470,000 app developers off developer accounts off the App Store. Developers, however, can create new accounts and continue to distribute new apps. Apple's central defense was that competition would loosen protection against unwanted apps that pose security risks to customers. Though the App Store rating section is filled with customer complaints referring to apps as scams, there's no way for Apple customers to report this to Apple, other than reaching out to regular Apple customer service representatives. Apple used to have a button just under the ratings and review section in the App Store that said "Report a problem," which allowed users to report inappropriate apps based on discussions among Apple's customers on Apple's own website. This feature was removed sometime back in 2016. FakeSpot, which helps consumers detect fake reviews on websites like Amazon, said the company had found that on average, about 25 to 30% of reviews on the App Store are fake. In 2019, Apple began filtering out the low-hanging fruit, but the company still misses the most sophisticated methods of fake reviews, which involve getting real people to post them. Apple rejects about a third of all submitted reviews and ratings. The idea of what makes a review fake is subjective, and that some reviews FakeSpot might consider inauthentic may be done by real people. There are sneakier ways to get good reviews. One method was employed by an app called Streamer for Fire Stick TV, which was rated 4.4 stars and had 8,500 ratings. The app, which charged users $3 a month or a one-time fee of $10 for a lifetime premium subscription, appears to be offered by Amazon. But it's not. What can I say? The glossy shine of Apple's reputation is starting to come off, and they have to turn that big ship around. Apple admits why its own Files app was ranked first when users search for competitor Dropbox. In 2019, facing down extensive investigations by the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times that showed Apple App Store clearly and consistently ranking its own apps ahead of competitors, Apple claimed it had done nothing wrong. A secret algorithm containing 42 different variables was working as intended. Top executives told the Times, insisting that Apple doesn't manually alter search results. Well, what brought this about? An intriguing email chain has surfaced during the Epic versus Apple trial, where it sure looks like Apple did the exact opposite, seemingly admitting it manually boosted the ranking of its own Files app ahead of the competition for 11 months. Apple claims that a metadata error, of course it's always an error, led to the Files app being boosted above Dropbox in its iOS App Store. It follows controversy after internal emails revealed Apple may have given Files a leg up over its rivals in the App Store for the Worldwide Developer Conference back in 2017. Apple's App Store is under intense scrutiny, with search results, adverts, and favoring of Apple's own products a big question of debate. Apple says that an error in the meta file of its Files app led to its appearing above Dropbox in the App Store when users search for the term, following the discovery of internal emails where Apple discussed boosting the app for the Worldwide Developer Conference. Emails filed as part of the Epic Games versus Apple trial revealed an email Tim Sweeney sent to Apple, complaining about the fact that when he searched for Dropbox on the App Store, he was met with an advert brought by Google and then Apple's own Files ahead of Dropbox. Apple's Matt Fisher responded by stating, "Who greenlit putting the Files app above Dropbox in organic search results? I didn't know we did that, and I don't think we should." An Apple employee stated in response, "I think the Files app was manually boosted on the top for the search query Dropbox during the last Worldwide Developer Conference." Fisher goes on to express his disapproval of the measure, stating, "I wasn't aware that we were boosting the Files app and would like to know how it happened and who requested it. In the future, I want any similar request to come to me for review and approval. We are removing the manual boost and the search results should be more relevant now," wrote Apple's app search lead Dabanka Nascar, after the company was confronted by Epic Games CEO Tim Sweeney over Apple's Files app showing up first when searching for Dropbox. "Dropbox wasn't even visible on the first page of the search results," Sweeney wrote. As you'll see, Nascar suggested that Files had been intentionally boosted for that exact search result during the last Worldwide Developer Conference, and that would have been Worldwide Developer Conference 2017, nearly a year earlier, when the Files app first debuted. The email chain actually reflects fairly well on Apple overall. Apple's Matt Fisher, VP of the App Store, clearly objects to the idea at first. "Who greenlit putting the Files app above Dropbox in organic search results? I didn't know we did that, and I don't think we should," he says. But he does end the conversation with, "In the future, I want any similar results to come to me for review and approval," suggesting he's not entirely ruling out future manual overrides. But Apple states that what we think we're seeing in these emails isn't quite accurate. Well, it's on hard copy. While Apple didn't challenge the idea that Files was unfairly ranked over Dropbox, the company says the reality was a simple mistake. The Files app had a Dropbox integration, so Apple put Dropbox into the app's metadata, and it was automatically ranked higher for Dropbox searches as a result. It was game. The best thing that Apple can do is just fess up to it and said, "It was wrong, it won't be done again." JBS says it paid $11 million ransom after cyber attack. The meat supplier JBS USA paid an $11 million ransom in response to a cyber attack that led to the shutdown of its entire U.S. beef processing operations last week. The ransom was paid after most of the company's facilities had come back online. This was a very difficult decision to make for our company, JBS said, and for us personally, said the CEO of JBS USA. However, we felt this decision had to be made to prevent any potential risk for our customers. JBS payment was first reported by the Wall Street Journal. The cyber attack affected servers supporting JBS IT systems in North America and Australia. The U.S. government has attributed the ransomware attack to Revil, that's R-E-V-I-L, a criminal gang believed to be based in Russia or Eastern Europe. Preliminary investigation results confirmed that no company, customer, or employee data was compromised, JBS said. JBS USA is part of JBS Foods, which it says is one of the world's largest food companies. It has operations in 15 countries and has customers in about 100 countries, according to its website. Its brand include Pilgrim's, Great Southern, and Aberdeen Black. Nikon to end camera production in Japan. Nikon Corporation is slated to end production of digital single-lens reflex cameras in Japan by the end of next March. Nikon is slated to end production of digital single-lens reflex cameras in Japan by the end of next March as digital camera market is shrinking amid the rise of smartphones. The company's domestic camera production has over 70 years of history. Operations at its last remaining domestic camera factory in Miyagi Prefecture will be transferred to Thailand. The Miyagi factory currently produces the D6 professional use camera. After the transfer, it will be used for making camera parts and other products. Nikon, along with Canon, has been leading the single-lens reflex camera market since 1948. Demand for such expensive cameras has been sluggish in recent years, however leading Nikon to incur a record net loss in the year through this March. Nikon also plans to close down two plants for replacement lens in the prefectures of Yamagata and Fukushima in late August. eBay and PayPal finally break up for good. It looks like the nearly 20 years long relationship between eBay and PayPal has quietly come to an end. On Monday, the auctioneering giant quietly updated its term of service to let sellers know that pretty soon, any funds they rake in will no longer be credited to their PayPal account. If sellers want to keep getting paid, any funds will need to be deposited directly into their bank account. When eBay manages payments, you can sell and get paid in one place, on eBay, without a need to pay third-party processing fees, the company wrote in an FAQ about the update. What eBay neglects to mention is that these managed payments come with a brand new processing fee from eBay, 30 cents, plus a certain fraction of whatever price an item ultimately goes for. That said, the company's promising sellers that whatever cut eBay ultimately takes will usually be lower than the roughly 13% they're currently forking over to both eBay and PayPal combined. On one website page explaining the new program, eBay noted that the deadlines for all users are phased. Some sellers are being told to swap out their PayPal login with the details from their checking account by midnight on June 1st. Others, eBay says, will get communications from the company sometimes before the year's end. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, A Lifetime of Learning.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. And what I'm going to talk about now is a little bit more than just business. This is something that you can do if you're young. This is something you can do if you're retired. This is something that it really applies across the board to everybody. It is a concept that really works well in business. It really is something that's going to help you to improve in any kind of business that you're in. But it applies to all of us. And that is learning. To me, learning is key. Why should we strive to keep learning? Why should we be driven to expand our minds? Why should we take new classes, discover new things, broaden our horizons? And in that, I think you might have an idea of where I'm going with this. But I'll tell you, I want to spell it out. I want to share this because I find that everything that I have dealt with over the course of the years, when I have slowed down my learning process, I have suffered. When I've sped it up, I've improved myself. Technology, for starters. Technology is always changing. Therefore, it's important that we keep learning. It's important that I keep that drive right up there, top, high on my list. Tops on the list. I'll go with tops on the list. I have been in the industry for 30 years. I'm going to go down just one vertical of knowledge that I have, and that is the manipulation of data and sorting out the statistics and the reporting of it. I started off learning something called Access. All right, Access is a database program that's been around for as long as Excel has been around. It allows you to manipulate the data a lot more efficiently, especially when we're dealing with less of the numbers that Excel is involved with and more of data records that Access is involved with. So I then moved along 10 years later into Crystal Reports, but I still continued to utilize Access. And then I learned VBA. Which is Visual Basic. Specifically, it's a brand of Visual Basic that's available through Microsoft. It was originally revolved around Visual Basic Access, but it's now code that's being used in Excel, and that's okay. But most any reporting tool now, I can sit down at it, and with a little bit of time and a little bit of guidance as to where the data is, I can dive into it. Or I can extract the data out of the database, whatever I'm dealing with, and put it into my home of Access. So I have mastered Access, but I keep going away from Access and trying to do something beyond. As a matter of fact, there's a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson: unless you try to do something beyond what you've already mastered, you will never grow. So I keep trying to learn more reporting programs and so forth and so on. But let's even shift gears. Along the way, I've learned about building your own PC. I will tell you, I've built many computers over the years. It's just part of my my excitement in computers was, I can build one. Oh, and I can expand it and I can do this and that. And then it was fun, but I also saved money. And then I actually wound up making money for years because I would not only build my own computer, but I would build a number of other computers for various clients. And then, of course, I've learned about networking and computer file servers, the network servers. I also learned 3D printing, which is not practical, but it's very, very fun. Alex Trebek, he said, learning something new is fun. Wow. And then let's even shift gears in another direction. You know, I've learned how to be a better leader. I've also gone forward and I've learned from being a leader. And these go hand in hand, but I've also, along the way, because of that, I've learned better customer service skills. I've learned better communication skills. I've learned better technical skills. Yes, technical skills, by keeping an open mind and listening to others who are technicians around me and sharing knowledge and bouncing things back and forth off of each other and building my knowledge that way. John F. Kennedy said, leadership and learning are indispensable to each other. it's just an exciting journey when you keep learning. Over the course of my career, I have tried so hard to keep the drive alive. Along the way, I decided I would try to hit just a few different goals. I read at least one nerdy technical book every year. And I also try to read one great nerd thinker book each year. And some of them, yeah, they're great thinkers, or at least we think of them as that, but they get into weird directions. But I also try to try out one new software package every 3 to 6 months. I also try to do old things in new ways. And I also try to do new things in old ways. And all of this, I do this to challenge my status quo, to challenge my thinking, my thought process, my journey forward, to disrupt it and maybe gain a little bit more knowledge. Clint Eastwood said, "Great stories teach you something." That's one reason I haven't slipped into some sort of retirement. I always feel like I'm learning something new. In this case, do you feel lucky? I couldn't resist. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Amazon Prime Day is June the 21st through the 22nd. This is an invented day by Amazon to promote sales. But many of the items you'll find on Prime Day aren't sold at actual discount. According to their website Finder.com in their release of the Amazon Prime Day shopping report, 26% of American adults, or 67.7 million people, are planning to spend their money on Amazon Prime Day. According to Finder's Amazon Prime Day shopping report, but of the 67.7 million Americans planning to spend on that day, only 11% of Americans say they plan to buy an Amazon product or an Amazon service like Amazon Prime. 8% of Americans say they'll buy an Amazon tech product, and 4% say they'll buy an Amazon service, with 1% of people planning to buy both. Meanwhile, 15% are planning to purchase non-Amazon products. 4% plan to spend on other consumer tech, 6% on clothing, accessories or makeup, and 7% plan to purchase products for the home. Slightly more women plan to shop on Amazon Prime Day. 28% of women plan to shop on Amazon Prime Day compared to 27% of men. Women are more likely than men to buy products across most categories, with the exception of Amazon tech and other consumer tech products. Many of the items will only be discounted by a few dollars. Worse, in the days leading up to the event, many sellers artificially inflate prices so their crappy deals look more appealing on Prime Day. You can get around this by using price tracking tools like CamelCamelCamel.com and FakeSpot.com. However, the artificial urgency created by time-sensitive lightning deals can act as a smokescreen against you doing your due diligence. You're likely to find deals on old, obsolete tech. This is particularly true for TVs and game consoles. Prime Day discounts are subpar. Competitors like Newegg and Best Buy, as well as Target and Walmart, have essentially been motivated by Prime Day to push up their own sales. These competitors are also likely to get you better prices on Apple and Google products, because Amazon has little incentive to help out its rivals. Similarly, midsummer isn't when you're going to see the biggest discounts in many product categories. Late August and early September are prime discount season, and you'll also see steeper discounts right before the holidays. The sole reason for Prime Day exists is to get you into signing up for a Prime subscription, and once you're trapped, ply you with discounted Amazon products. Generally speaking, Prime Day's best deals are on Kindles, Amazon Echoes, and Fire Sticks. In other words, Amazon owns gadgets. This year, Amazon will give you a $10 credit for every $10 you spend in its small business category on Prime Day. The credits are, of course, for more Amazon purchases, but possibly not the kind you want. In the terms and conditions, you'll find that the credit is not valid for digital products like instant video downloads, Kindles, ebooks, digital music, or Amazon gift card subscriptions, Prime memberships, or Prime Now orders, among other limitations. Another issue is that with each passing year, shopping on Amazon in certain categories is a minefield. There's been an influx of counterfeits, expired products, and some shady third-party sellers hawking their garbage. You might still think of Amazon as a digital big box store, but these days it's more akin to a huge online flea market. And while Amazon reportedly sees and destroy more than 2 million counterfeit products and block more than 10 million bad listings in 2020, it also aggressively lobbied against the Informed Consumer Act, which would have required it to authenticate the identity of the third-party sellers, and succeeded. Amazon's annual deals extravaganza for Prime members will officially kick off June the 21st, that's next week, and continue into June the 22nd. Amazon has now confirmed that the earlier-than-usual summer date marks a return to a mid-year window after last year's delay. The last Prime Day by Amazon was held in October of last year. Amazon Prime Day will occur on the 21st and June the 22nd. When Prime Day arrives, we expect a healthy selection of preview deals over the weekend prior to the Prime Day kickoff. Except for last year, Prime Day has always occurred in July, so this shift to June represents a slight but significant change. Amazon's competitors have held their own late June and early July events in recent years. Target just announced its own deals event called Deal Days, set for June the 20th to June the 22nd, and we expect to see other competing sales this year as well. However, if you want to get Prime Day deals and haven't signed up for a free Prime trial before, you can try Prime for 30 days, including during Prime Day, at no cost. Just remember, however, to cancel before you build. Technically, you have to be a Prime member to get Prime Day deals on Amazon.com. However, if you want to get Prime Day deals and haven't signed up yet for a free Prime trial before, you can try Prime for 30 days, including during Prime Day, at no cost. Just remember to cancel before you build. Now is a safe time to sign up for such a trial, as the dates of the event have been confirmed for the 21st and the 22nd. If you don't want to join Amazon, even on a trial basis, look out for competing sales or Prime Day price matches from Amazon competitors like Best Buy, Walmart, and Target. Target recently announced its own Deal Days event, set to run from June 20th to the 22nd. The pandemic continues to impact everything, though. Last year's Prime Day, delayed from its typical summer date until mid-October, was no exception. In 2021, Prime Day in the United States will have slightly earlier summer start dates, as Amazon has now confirmed the event will take place June the 21st and the 22nd. Amazon's move to an earlier second quarter date is reportedly meant to address pandemic-related concerns, namely a potential July transportation slowdown and the pandemic-delayed Olympics in early May. In early May, Amazon announced Prime Day delays in both Canada and India, as both countries continue to contend with coronavirus outbreaks. Another factor to consider is the pandemic-driven global semiconductor shortage, which could impact the availability of all manners of new electronics, from phones to game consoles, making for fewer and smaller discounts. The ongoing pandemic and associated shifts in shopping behavior have also presented an opportunity for manufacturers and retailers to reset the market for everyday items. The extent to which that will impact the quality of Prime Day discounts is unknown, but deals on household essentials that were noted during past Prime Days could be affected. My advice is, unless you have an urgency to purchase a needed product today, the real discounts will be around Black Friday. AT&T donates $2 billion to help bridge the digital divide. AT&T announced an initiative to bring strong, reliable broadband connectivity to more Americans through special low-cost offers. Their participation in emergency broadband benefit and community involvement. With an investment of $2 billion over the next 3 years, this initiative was created to address what has been called a digital divide. The digital divide began with the high cost of computers, which limited access for those who could not afford to buy a device. Given the necessity of the internet over the years, that created a major disadvantage. There was also the usability factor. Those not educated on the myriad of uses of the technology and the equipment that supports it. As technology creeps more and more into our lives, though, equipment affordability becomes less and less. What does remain a factor, though, is reliable access to the web and general digital literacy. With AT&T's commitment to bring affordability, educational resources, and economic opportunities to millions of Americans facing the digital divide, the aim is to create a more harmonious society through digital equality. How will AT&T do this? AT&T plans to expand affordable broadband through its low-cost offer and the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program administered by the FCC. An announcement from AT&T details the 3 points of the plan as follows. Education offers. Discounted wireless solutions are offered to more than 135,000 public and private K-12 schools, colleges, and universities. These offers help keep students and teachers connected in a one-to-one learning model to assist in transforming education beyond when schools reopen. Access from AT&T. Introduced 5 years ago, this AT&T-funded program makes the internet more affordable for customers by providing qualifying households with wireline internet service at $10 or less per month. This voluntary offer from AT&T has no contract or installation fee. Plus, it includes in-home Wi-Fi at no additional cost. Emergency broadband benefit. Eligible customers will be able to temporarily reduce their monthly broadband costs by taking advantage of the Federal Emergency Broadband Benefit. This government program administered by the FCC will allow more than 30 million eligible households to receive an additional subsidy of up to $50 a month. Those on tribal lands are eligible for up to $75 per month. The monthly cost of broadband after applying the Emergency Broadband Benefit can fall to as low as $0 a month, in other words, free. The Emergency Broadband Benefit can be applied to eligible home internet services like access from AT&T or AT&T Internet available within 21 state wireline footprint, or it can be applied towards eligible postpaid or prepaid wireless plans at AT&T, AT&T Prepaid, and Cricket Wireless, which are available in all 50 states. Once customers verify that they are eligible, AT&T will apply the benefit to the customer's service until the emergency broadband benefit ends. The Uniform Program Start Program is pending an FCC announcement. Building educational foundations. In addition, AT&T has engaged with AT&T Connected Learning, an initiative to help children learn in new and exciting ways as the pandemic wanes. AT&T Connected Learning is a multi-year commitment that builds on previous investments and long-standing commitments to education. It includes multiple solutions to connect learners with the resources and opportunities for success in school and in life. Together with WarnerMedia, AT&T is developing a digital learning platform that will deliver educational content wherever students are. Exclusive educational content from WarnerMedia properties and talent, learning tools from leading education groups to help students and families navigate distance learning and improve academic success, and in collaboration with AT&T employees and local organizations, the company will launch 20 AT&T Connected Learning Centers in 2021. The Connected Learning Centers will be in underserved neighborhoods where accessing connectivity can often be a challenge. Each facility will feature high-speed AT&T fiber internet, Wi-Fi for devices like laptops and tablets, and full access to the WarnerMedia content library. Tutoring and mentorship through the AT&T Believes Volunteer Initiative will also be available. Partnering with the Public Library Association, a division of the American Library Association, AT&T will also offer digital literacy courses for parents and children to help build the skills to help families navigate distance learning and participate effectively and safely. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 24th at 6:45 p.m., and they have short technical topics covering the future of publishing, artificial intelligence, mixed reality, and machine learning. Meeting is online, virtual meeting via Zoom. BCUG.com is the website for more information. Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, July 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Tesla and the electric car. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is wpcug.org for more meeting ID information. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, July the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. And their online virtual meeting is via Jitsi. So their website is acgnj.org for meeting ID information. This coming Sunday is June the 20th, the first day of summer and it's Father's Day. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.